At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening. And today, I have a special guest, one that you know and love, Mr. Greg Hunter.
Give it up
for him.
All right.
On the stage. Here's the thing. This case was, something I felt I couldn't do alone. And I'd love to talk to you guys about it. But
I live in her house.
So you're the old standby.
Exactly.
But because of the proximity Greg and I have, it's easier to discuss it with him. Plus, I love him. Otherwise, I would have to look you all up on Truth Finder and stalk you, find your phone numbers, cold call you. And which I've been known to do. Shout out Hannah.
Watch out. You send your number to Rachel O'Brien, you just might get a cold call.
You don't even have to give me your number.
She'll find you.
Oh, I'll find it. If you're in prison, don't worry. I'll write you in prison. Doesn't matter. It's who I am and it's my journey. Anyways, but this case was just too intense. There's so much to contemplate. I couldn't just do a linear storyline. Today's case is wild, tragic, and up for grabs on the truth. It involves a Texas housewife, Sunday school teacher, church-going mother of two, and a community also seemingly so innocent and suburban, Christian, and simple. A booming town. If you watch the two new docuseries which came out in 2022 and 2023, you might be hard-pressed to come up with an opinion. Who was Candy? Who is she now? Was this an act of self-defense or a woman snapped? Selfish, narcissistic, perhaps. I'll leave it up to you to decide. I'm honestly floored myself and still have yet to reach a conclusion. Well, that was until today, when I think I did. I had thought that the research that I had done that led to the end of the trial would end this story. But this morning, before recording today, I decided to dig a little more. And I may be perhaps more disturbed by what happens after the murder and the trial and the affair. Listen, it's disturbing and confusing all around, but it really makes you think about what lingers within the human psyche. Okay, Greg. So I found this story because I really enjoyed this episode that Ash from Morbid did about the backstory behind the TV show Dallas. And I was like, ooh, rich people doing shady things. Because I was kind of getting sick of, I don't know, the same like cult story, because it is a playbook after a while. I still love them. I'll still be doing cults. But like, you got to shake it up sometimes. And you got to shake it up too when, you know, I've been so invested in Amanda Winkowski's story and the Lisk murders and Father Joe's story. I guess I just wanted to shake it up and maybe do something a little lighter. However, you know what? This is actually just as dark, if not more.
It's got a pretty backdrop, a nice suburban, you know, you'd never expect it, cookie cutter white picket fence backdrop, but no, it's pretty dark.
Yeah, when you get into it, I was like, okay, I regret this now, but we're in it. But I just Googled like
like wealthy, prominent pastor kills wife or something, or like rich people that do sinister things or something.
So this was just a random Google.
It's a
shot in the dark.
Yes.
You nailed it. I mean, this is like a classic Seven Deadly Sinners. I do feel like happy about it. Because I'm always pushing you. Like, we got to get back to the classics, you know? Like televangelists, you know, Christian churches that you can't believe what the pastor did. Or in this case, the congregation, the choir.
Mm-hmm. Totally. But I feel like after a while, like I have to be inspired by like the research. I'm just like, sometimes when it's cults, it's like, it's the same playbook. Okay, we get it. We get it. We get it.
Yeah, it is the same playbook.
I mean, it's always interesting, but like, I got to branch off here and there, you know?
I like this branch.
Okay. So that's how I found it. And so a Texas Monthly article, which is like kind of the foremost true crime of Texas.
Love that publication.
It really is. Skip Hollandsworth. No, they do like.
Oh, they're known.
Oh my God, yes. They're huge. They have their own podcast. No, they're huge.
Well, Texas is a big state, you know.
Yeah. But it's like a really well done publication. Well, not that I've ever like held it in my hand and read it. Frankly, I barely read the articles.
No one does that anymore. They watch it on their screens. They read it on their screens. Reading it, all right?
I have things dictated to me from the computer because I can't sit still.
Even better, AI. You got your talk bot, you know, telling you the story.
And that's exactly what happened on this. And that's probably half the reason why I chose it, where I was like, oh my God, it's two articles. Okay, it says it's a 60-minute read. Oh, I can press play. Thank God.
That's awesome. Well done, Texas Monthly, for having that feature.
It is an AI voice, though, I'm pretty sure. It's very monotone. But
I don't think there's anyone on the other end reading it to you.
Yeah. Regardless, I have to help build a house, all right? I live on a ranch.
Your hands.
Yeah. I got to go feed our horse. And so.
He's a good boy.
He is. So anyways, it's very nice when something is just said to me and then I can like stop and take notes. All right. Regardless.
So I never had the pleasure of reading the Texas Monthly article about this story. I only was introduced to it by the HBO and Hulu narrative series where they've dramatized. That's not how you say that word. Dramatized.
That's why I'm making you introduce this because I couldn't say.
That's a tough word.
I couldn't say it. So I was like, Greg, just do it.
All right, behind the scenes scoop here. We've done this a couple of times.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so we started off with the Hulu series, and I got to admit, the first like 15, 20 minutes, I was bored. I was bored stiff. I was like, Rachel, why are you making me watch a show about like late 70s suburbia in Texas? This is the most boring thing I've ever seen. Then bam!
Well, it was before the 80s and like it was before it became like Technicolor and flashy. It was still when everything was brown. So it was like late 70s, early 80s where everything's
Brady
brown.
Brady Bunch. Every house just reminded me of the Brady Bunch. But we should let you know that this is the story of Candy Montgomery and how she murdered
Betty Gore.
Betty Gore. What led up to it? What happened? And everything in between in the middle of nowhere, Texas suburbia in the late 70s.
The only thing I wanted to interject is it's been so hard for me and it was hard for you when I first introduced you to this, because if you take Betty Gore's husband, which is Alan Gore, and you just think Al Gore, it's like, is that the politician? I remember that politician when I was a kid.
Yeah, you said Al Gore to me like in the middle of as we were watching the series, and I hadn't like, you know, comprehended and committed to memory all of the characters' names. And I'm like, Al Gore comes into this? I mean, Candy's a manipulative person. I could believe it, but. And then it occurred to me who you were referring to.
Yeah, and then we went like down a politician like rabbit hole of like names we heard when we were like in kindergarten. I was like, there was a guy who was like Ross Perot. But it took me a while to figure out that one.
Bob Dole.
That one Greg pulled out of his ass.
I was guessing and I was like, are you thinking of Bob Dole?
I have not heard that name.
Threw Rachel back. And then literally not even 60 seconds later in the show, Alan Gore talks about how Bob Dole gave him some prize, like 4-H. I forget what he won. Rocket thinking
something. I was like, Greg, you're psychic.
Or... it was a really boring prize that he had won, but
anyway, so that's just your history lesson on politicians in the 80s and 90s.
That didn't quite make it.
Yeah, but they were trying. Okay.
Career politicians, you know?
Yeah. So this is, like Greg said, the story of Candy Montgomery and the murder of Betty Gore. This is a new format for us to like occasionally do these like chatty episodes. So please bear with us if it's not like perfectly scripted, but perhaps you'd enjoy Greg's voice being 50% of it more than just like Rachel just fucking strong arming you.
You're getting it either way.
But it is such a complicated story. And the church was at the center of this terrible tragedy. Yet I feel tragedy implies an accident, don't you?
Yeah, I mean...
like an unwillful act that everyone was none the wiser to or expected or had a hand in.
Yeah.
Seems accidental.
Tragedy usually, yeah, comes... it seems like there's a bit of unexpected, unplanned nature to it.
Yeah. But this was a tragedy of intention, however.
Well said.
A deliberate affair, emotions that followed, and for a time, a deliberate cover-up. A good defense, though, and the cracks in the souls left to pick up the pieces of two people's, well, I'll let you decide. Tell us what you think at Seven Deadly Sinners podcast on Instagram, or DM us on our personal accounts, but do you think, is it stupidity, ego, selfish nature, or just, I don't know, they didn't mean to?
They meant to.
Yeah, well, let's go back to the church, Greg, where all the faithful parties meet.
What a perfect location.
It's so innocent.
For a story like this. Yeah. Innocent. Church choir.
Yeah. A white church. But before the white church in Collin County, Texas, there were two couples meeting. Candy met her husband, Pat, which we're going to sidebar very quickly if you watch the HBO Max documentary.
It's the enemy.
Almost Famous, which is my favorite movie of all time. And there were so many times where I was like, Greg, I can't watch this. I can't see
him. It's hard to get over. It's too obvious. I'm just like, oh, that's the big enemy. He's all grown up. Oh, that's the, you know, little kid from Almost Famous. And he's nobody else. He's definitely that kid and only that kid.
I know, but that's unfair to him. We should figure out his actual name. Because I actually love that. And he's very endearing in this, you know, dramatization series or whatever, docuseries. But at first I was like, wait, is that the kid from Almost Famous? No, it can't be. He's an adult now? Like, I, like, was so, like, freaked out by it. I was like, Greg, there's no way. But he also kind of acts like him. He's very sweet in this. I like that actor. What's his name?
Pat Fugit. Mm. Patrick Fugit.
Patrick Fugit, you're an unbelievable actor, and you radiate kindness. I'll give you that.
It's true.
But you also, I still was like, it's like typecasting, I guess, now.
Episodes 1 through 4, I really couldn't get over it. And then in the 5th, or maybe it was the 4th episode, I can't remember. At some point, he won me over and I related with him and I felt so bad for him. And I was just like, oh, poor guy. I almost teared up.
Yeah, he's a doll. But it's kind of like, you know, this is a bad example, but Linda Blair, who played the girl in like The Exorcist.
Mm-hmm. Never got another role.
It just, people only saw her as that.
I mean, it's a sign of a good movie, but like, yeah, it's like, oh, you're like the Verizon guy or the Allstate girl, a Progressive girl, whatever. You know,
it's just like your brain goes to that.
Exactly.
What's the guy, and we'll get back on track, from 10 Cloverfield Lane, who I never saw as this person, then I saw that movie, then I was like, well, now he's a bad guy.
John Goodman?
Yeah.
Well, John Goodman's great. I mean, he's a great actor.
He's a great actor. He was always funny. And then I saw him in that movie. And now I'm just like, oh, that movie scared me.
I think he just crushed it in that.
Well, he did.
He took our opinions and just was like, whoa, he's not funny.
I know. I'm just saying. Like your brain, it's hard for your brain to readjust.
I think the problem with Pat Fugit in this is that like he's playing the same exact guy, just like grown up.
And so I'm the enemy. I could do a lot of dangerous
things to you.
I feel like the enemy we're getting it wrong.
But that's exactly who he is to his wife too. Like, I'm the enemy. He's like, oh, go. You're gonna hurt me. I don't know. It's funny. It's like I haven't seen him in anything else in 20 years, and then boom, he crops up, and it's just like, oh.
But I'm sure he's been in a ton of shit. We're just not paying attention.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, we'll get back on track. See, if we keep doing this format, which, spoiler, this might be a part two because you'll hear in a second. It gets so much worse than we were expecting. But if we keep doing this format, give us grace and patience. We're learning how to, you know.
Do-si-do.
Do-si-do, yeah. That's a good analogy for marriage. Yeah.
We got that down, just the podcasting.
It's going all right. Listen to Deadly Diocese. That's the one we have together. Anyways, okay. So before the White Church in Collin County, Texas, there were two couples meeting, Candy and Pat. They met while they were working at Texas Instruments. Candy was a
great calculators.
That's all I can think about every time, and I just didn't want to interject that. I was like, had oh, great, to. Algebra, cool. Yeah. Calculus, maybe that's what I needed it for. They were expensive, too.
Yeah, it's all a gimmick.
Yeah. Well, whatever. At least it made Pat some money, because he needed it after Candy committed murder.
Woo!
Anywho, Candy was a secretary, Pat an electrical engineer. And it was everything every parent would want, because Pat was like the most like shining star electric, like he was the brightest, you know, up and coming guy at the company. So like, yeah, he's smart, he's sweet, he's even keeled, he's successful. I mean, pretty damn successful. He's no like oil baron in Texas, but he was making 70 grand, which was the equivalent of like 300 grand today. That's great. Yeah. Fucking money. And they, at least what's shown in the, I'm going to say docuseries, it's easier. I can't say dramatization. At least what's shown in the docuseries, he had a beautiful, like, interesting, architecturally cool house. Like, he was making good money.
Yeah.
So, Candy should have been happy, and it's fine if you're not in love, but whatever. She said she was in love with him, but she was bored. So despite the two kids and the beautiful house and the husband who loved her, I will say it appears, you know, both in the Texas Monthly article and the docuseries, but he kind of had a hard time showing it in the way that Candy wanted. But could anyone actually give Candy exactly what she wanted?
No. She was insatiable. It seemed that way.
I agree.
She had it all, but needed more.
No, she's so complicated. Again, like I said at the beginning of this, I was so confused until something I'm going to reveal in the part two, which for me was, I absolutely drew the line in the sand, and I hate to tease it, unless of course this is going to end up being short, but I don't think so because there's so much to cover. I can't reveal it until part two.
Okay.
And I'm not revealing it until Greg, until he hears it live on the podcast.
I'm on the edge of my seat.
It's horrifying.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, well, I'll stop now. Okay. So Candy being insatiable, like you said, do you remember when she said to her friend Sherry she needed fireworks? And she was like talking to a few friends that she was looking to have an affair?
Yeah, she was on the hunt.
Yeah. She wanted like transcendental sex.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, her husband's providing for her. She's got two beautiful kids, got a great life. And it's okay to be unhappy, but to be so bold to like just be talking to your friends, like your church-going friends too. Just like, I'm looking to have an affair. I need fireworks.
That's pretty good Texas girl accent.
Well, I don't know. She's A-type though, and she was going to track down that affair. It wasn't just like, she had like a mission.
She's going to start those fireworks.
Yeah.
She's going to light them off in the stand. Wasn't going to pay for them.
But didn't you find that weird that it wasn't like, she didn't have anyone in mind until she did. But she was just like, I need an affair. I need to live. This is a rediscover me moment.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't think it was that surprising. But to the level and ability that she was able to go after it was. I think a lot of bored housewives, especially in that era, it's like they got TV, they got a rotary phone, they're all alone at home. Eventually boredom prevails, and then, you know, a woman like that who's like, you know, popular girl syndrome, never been told no, is like, I need more. I need more. I'm worth more. I deserve more. And then, you know, with the help of her friends who were like, you do, and not really talking her out of it.
Fair. But it doesn't it also, when we get into it more, like, I've never had an affair. I don't quite know how it works, but I would think, like, the spontaneity of it would seem more appealing than, like, the PowerPoint presentation.
Certainly.
Thing the that way she that, does.
I mean, I think that that probably, in some regards, like, foiled her plan before it even started. Like, she wanted fireworks, but what she got was some calculated backstabbing. And also, like, weird to go with someone that your kids are involved with. Like, your children, it's the family of your daughter's friend. Like, that seems so strange to me. Like, why not go to Vegas and have a one-night stand?
Okay, that's a good point. I was going to say I disagree because, like, I think you said something like, why go with that approach? But I think that approach worked with the guy she chose, because I think Alan Gore was an extremely weak, and I stand by this, Alan, I think you're still alive. I apologize for the trauma you've been through. You also kind of put yourself in that position. I think he is an extremely weak man that she spotted that. This is just my opinion.
Oh, I agree with that.
And he was...
She preyed upon that for sure.
And he was at first unwilling to go through it. So let's go through the timeline of the affair.
Okay.
Okay. So, all right. So she wanted an affair. So Perky Candy Montgomery set out to track down this affair. And it was like God appeared on that Methodist Church volleyball court that day. When Candy was playing on the same team as churchgoer Alan Gore, and they collided trying to get a volleyball.
Boom. Sparks.
Fireworks. And as boring as Alan Gore may have seemed to some people, he was already had a receding hairline. Let's say you couldn't count abs on his stomach, you know, whatever. But when they collided, Candy said he smelled sexy.
It's a testament to cologne, gentlemen.
No, honestly.
I put some on before we podcasted.
And you smell, I can't smell you, but you've showered, so that's perfect.
There we go.
I love you. This is a really weird case to do with your husband, because both of us are like, we'd never have an affair. And it's like, but like, as listeners, are you like, oh, you guys are so perfect, you know? But you'll hear from this case that, like, no one is this shady.
Yeah. I mean, it was a hard thing to watch and fathom and process after a while. I was like, man, I really feel bad for these people. Like, I don't, if anything, I think this has only informed me of all the, you know, the reasons why you really don't want to even think about it.
Or make a PowerPoint presentation. And that's why this case is so weird. Like, people are human, like, you know, whatever. I don't condone cheating. Hopefully neither of us will ever cheat on each other. You know, life happens though, but this is specifically, like, it's predatory.
And just the way that it gets out of hand. I mean, it's like the universe won't allow this to happen, and it's striking back. And I do believe that that always happens. Like, if you cheat on someone, the universe is going to conspire to get you caught and to make you repent for your sins.
I honestly thought when you said the universe wouldn't allow this to happen, you were referring to Candy's perseverance in making it happen. Turned down several times.
No. I think that, like, once they conspired to have an affair, like, as they got deeper involved, I feel like it was only, like, an expression of energy catapulting in the other direction, and it was always bound to come back just as strong in the other direction, like physics. And, like, I truly do believe every friend I've ever had in my younger years, college, whatever, like, there's always a situation if another girl comes around or if, you know, cheating becomes a thing with somebody, it's just like it always comes back to slap them in the face. It's just I don't know almost anyone who's ever like they cheated, they got away with it, and they lived happily ever after. Like, that's just not how those stories end. And in this case, Candy and Alan Gore thought that they could beat the system, thought they were better than the universal plan in motion, and thought they could get away with it. And it's one thing to do it once, it's another thing to do it twice, but to continue, like, they had an affair.
Oh, yeah.
And devoted lots of energy to it, and that energy goes somewhere. In my mind, you got to think of all the hours lost, you know, devoted to planning, and just like they got very meticulous, didn't they, Rachel?
Oh, yeah. I believe like Candy was like, could like him smelling, you know, sexy be a secret of the night, or really a secret of 2 hour daytime lunches that lasted months? And you'll understand what I mean by 2 hour daytime lunches, but that didn't just spark immediately. Like, sure, Alan would wink at her occasionally. They both sang in the church choir. And Candy felt a vibe. She was all kind of nervous. She would talk to her friend, like, I think he kind of likes me. Meanwhile, you have a husband and kids. But, like, there's something about Candy that is very... I can't figure out, and this is more for part two, because I'm giving you my opinion based on the whole thing. But if there's something very juvenile, or she doesn't understand social cues, or if it's selfish... narcissistic.
I think it's just popular girl syndrome. Like, she just has never been told no. It seems like she's never been told no. She was the lead cheerleader, always got what she wanted. It just kind of seems that way.
Okay. I actually like your lead in with that. I was going to go with something else, but this could be a good time to introduce Betty Gore, who deserves more attention than she's given in these dramatization series. It is kind of heartbreaking that it is all about Candy, because I think, yes, Candy's the most fascinating, like a suburban housewife axe murderer. We didn't say axe. Well, spoiler alert, she's an axe murderer.
Axe murderer. That's what makes this whole thing just...
Yeah. But Betty Gore isn't given enough attention. So actually, I'm going to go off my script here because I like your lead in. Let's talk a little bit about Betty Gore, because Betty was actually... at least in Texas Monthly, and I think in just in general, she was actually more likable with the boys. She had a big smile. She was more traditionally pretty. She was just, I think, less like spunky and manipulative, maybe. I think maybe like very reserved with like her sexuality, or this is kind of just my own like, you know, conjecture, but I've done enough research on it. This is just the vibe I'm getting. She was traditionally pretty, but maybe kind of like a perfectionist, not in the Candy way, but more in like a, she was more reserved. And I think that the biggest thing with Betty Gore, I almost said Montgomery, sorry. After she married her husband, they met at a Methodist college after she married Alan Gore and had her kids. I think she struggled with postpartum depression. And the thing that's in the Texas Monthly article, and they say that at up top, and like they said they didn't like reprint it or change anything because they said they wanted it to be like historical for the time. So think it was 1980s male writers, no offense to men, but like they didn't really understand postpartum and like, you know, you can write her as like this nagging sort of like hypochondriac, like whiny wife, but she was actually just struggling with something deeper that no one understood at the time.
It's something that I feel like, you know, kind of went under the radar and was never pointed out to me. But as I watched this series, really jumped out at me was that like this affair happened while Betty was pregnant. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that could have not only contributed to the postpartum depression, but like all the energy and time and emotion that Alan was not directing to her. Because he was fulfilled in so many ways, in so many departments, sexually, emotionally, you know, when he came home from work, that like that drab neutralization of their relationship over months. And then a kid comes out, like, of course she's going to have postpartum depression. And also like, you know, it seems like Alan brought it upon himself.
Yeah. And people, like, she's not stupid. Like, she wasn't crazy to think something was off. And that's also a good point. Like, he was getting it, like, somewhere else. She, one of the sadder parts in this story is Betty was very, I mean, I guess it was just raised very religious, or was just like, you know, a sign of the times is just like sex. We don't talk about it. We're not like, we're not wild girls. We don't do things like that. We don't initiate. Yeah. She, during the affair that he was having with Candy, and he had spent the entirety having sex with Candy, or at least on his 2-hour lunch breaks, which we'll go back into. He was too spent when he got home because he'd been having sex with another woman all day. By the way, Betty's friend. Candy and Betty are friends. Friends. That's a whole other thing we have to get into. But Betty, like got herself the courage to like initiate sex with Alan, and he rebuffed her because he was tired because he'd been having an affair. Your body kind of knows, and your brain knows, like, okay, something's weird here. Or now she felt so self-conscious, so horrible about herself. That
certainly.
And even Alan told Candy about it. He was like, I feel so bad. Like, I told her no, but like, you know, like, there's no way that Betty didn't know something was going on. And there's something I need to clarify in this. I think I have it somewhere in my notes, but I'm pretty sure no one ever told Betty. She started to sense this affair.
And I'm going to give a pregnant woman like superpowers, like, I think their intuition is going to be heightened. I think, like, she knew. She definitely knew. Not only did she know that Alan's energy was going somewhere else, but I think she was able, I mean, at least it does seem in the HBO's depiction of it, that she would have been able to hone in on their energies together and knew that it was Candy who was taking her husband away from her.
Yeah. I think Candy's a presence. She's like, she's kind of an in-your-face presence. Okay. So let's go back to how the affair started. So we went into, but let's just give Betty Gore real quickly. She was beautiful. She was a good mom. By all accounts, it seems. She is not this, like, she's, a, you know, depicted as this nagging wife. And I think that's very unfair. Like, there's many layers. And I think we've done that. But
she didn't
just
deserve the fate she encountered.
Yes. Although we'll see that maybe she initiated it, but we don't know. But she doesn't deserve for, like, Candy to, you know, to be the Candy show. And Betty's just this, you know, nagging wife. Like, she was a human and seems like a wonderful person. She did everything right. She had postpartum. She's a little tired. Okay. A little freaked out. Her husband was probably cheating on her, and she was probably shocked because he was unattractive at best. Anyways. So because it sets up who Candy and Alan are as people, specifically Candy, though, in this part of the situation, let's talk about the timeline of an affair. So, sparks fly when they bonk each other on the volleyball court or whatever. She says he smells sexy. Okay. Some winks, some flirtations, some like lingering conversations after church events, you know, commence.
And so finally all this flirtation culminates into Candy finally getting the courage to really address Alan face to face. And one night after choir practice, she approaches his car, gets in, and says plainly, "Would you be interested in having an affair?"
Who's that bolt?
Well, Alan didn't know what to say, and in fact, that's what he said. He said, "I don't know what to say." And then Candy says, "It's just something I've been thinking about and wanted to say it so I don't have to think about it anymore." Alan says, "I don't think I could, Candy. I don't think it would be a wise thing to do because I love Betty. Once we were living in New Mexico, she had an affair, and that hurt me a lot, and I wouldn't want to do that to her." And Candy says, "That's fine, Alan. I love Pat, too. I wouldn't want to hurt him either." Then Alan reveals that Betty just got pregnant again, too, and it would be unfair to her, especially since I don't feel the same way about you that I do about her. So I probably couldn't do something like that. Candy responds, "Okay, Alan, I was just putting the option out there because of how I felt, and it's up to you to decide. I don't want to hurt your marriage. All I wanted to do was go to bed. I won't mention it again." Then Alan leaned across the seat and kissed Candy on the lips.
Now picture Candy, at least how she's depicted in the dramatizations, being like, "Okay, I just had to get off my chest." But she was wrecked with anxiety for like 2 weeks, being like, "But he kissed me. Is he into it? Is he not into me?" And then she got a phone call, actually on her birthday, 2 weeks later. It was her 29th birthday. It was Alan. He said, "Hi, this is Alan. I have to go to McKinney tomorrow to get some tires checked on the new truck I bought up there. I wondered if you'd like to have lunch, you know, to talk a little bit more about what we talked about before." So it had been 2 or 3 weeks since the last time they had talked in the parking lot outside the gym. And Candy was anxious. I mean, overly confident, but not one to be like, you said, like, she's the popular girl. No one says no.
Exactly.
Like, she's like, this is crazy. So they have lunch and he actually gives her a birthday card, which made her feel extra special. And so they sit down at another lunch and discuss outlining this affair. And again, it's like a PowerPoint presentation. It is literally so businesslike. And they don't hook up that day. It's still sort of like the pros and cons. Like, okay, we can never have feelings. Like, this is just sex. It's very like, and if any of us catch feelings, it ends right away. No one has to know, that type of thing.
They think they're being smart about it.
Exactly. But you can't be, really.
It's just a dumb decision.
Well, they think they're being smarter on the next encounter, though. So they don't have sex that day. So then there's another. So Alan's able to have 2-hour lunch breaks. I guess he's like pretty good up in his company. Yeah. So he's.
What job does he got?
I don't know. One in which he's able to have 2-hour lunch breaks.
That's just how it was in the 70s.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that some of the men didn't, but when you're having an affair and Candy's also cooking you 3-course meals during it, which we'll get to. yeah. So basically, they don't have sex on that. Like, nothing happens on that encounter. And then they have another meetup. And at this one, he goes to Candy's house. He walks in and Candy has 2 sheets of paper up that's like the whys and the why nots of how to do this affair. Plus, like her famed lasagna or some meal that she, and she's just being, God, I got to make sure they were actually in her house. I think that they were, which just makes me feel sick.
They were
Pat.
In the series. I know that. I was like, what? Why would they meet there? They're being safe.
Yeah, that's, yeah. So they eventually get safe at the Como Hotel or whatever, or motel. You'll see. So
it's a motel. If it's house and affairs, it's a motel. Even if it says hotel outside, it's a motel.
Well, what's funny is they had 2 places that they would meet, and they decided to just stick with the one that was like $3 less per hour or $6 less. I can't remember.
Because they wanted to feel skanky.
She actually said she liked the seediness of it. That's interesting that you say that. That was,
It's what they're out for.
However, she would come with like a 3-course meal, like dessert, homemade dessert, who wants to have sex after a lasagna dessert and like an appetizer, but whatever.
Sex first.
Yes. You would be farting all over the place. Anyways, and I would feel fat, so I don't know. He walks in, and this is what wins him over, because he's, I think, got an analytical mind, you know?
Yeah.
And he loved...
She was probably playing to that.
That's
you're right. He's all math-oriented. He's pros and cons. He's black and white. And so she was like, how do I... She's just so manipulative.
Yep.
That she was like, this will get him. This will turn him on.
I like that you noticed that, because that was something I said, we'll talk about that later on something you said earlier. But like, yeah, she knew that was like, that would play into, like, she's working him. She's working him into it.
She always gets her way.
One step. High five on that. I'm not trying to hate on you, Candy. I'm sure you're a great therapist now. Spoiler alert. But just Candy gets her goddamn way.
There's lots of people out there that do.
Yeah.
And they can use it for good or bad.
Yeah. So it makes him laugh and it makes him fall for it.
Turned him on.
It did. And
all she had to do was stack up more whys than why not.
Exactly. Bam. And promise, like, no one will catch feelings. Yet she was the one, allegedly.
That caught feelings.
However, he wrote her love letters. Like, that's all complicated. But
he was horny. That's why he wrote her love letters. I think Candy got emotionally involved, but I don't think Alan Gore ever did. I think it was a sexual
attention thing. She gave him attention when he thought a girl like him would never give him attention.
Yes, attention. You know, it was a pleasure cove for him, you know.
Pleasure cruise is what I thought you were
pleasure
gonna say.
Cruise. Exactly. No, it was. It was just a pleasure cruise for him. It was never gonna last forever in his mind. And it was something that I think was very superficial. And he looked at it superficially. And so when he started to realize on the surface that it was affecting his marriage and his family life, he was prepared to end it and ready to end it. And Candy couldn't handle that.
But do you think it's that she couldn't handle, because she's the one that started it off with like, this is just sex, this is just whatever. Do you think that she actually caught feelings or couldn't handle not being number one?
Well, that's a loaded question. I mean, I think it's one and the same. She cared because she caught feelings, but Candy doesn't get told no. Candy's number one. Candy makes the decisions. And that's definitely at least how it played out in the HBO series and how they portrayed it.
I feel like I'm hating on her when initially it was like my mind changed today after 2 weeks of being like very sympathetic towards her at certain points. So I apologize if it seems like I'm being mean. And again, I want to hear your opinions, but it's like there was something that changed my opinion.
It's like the theme song.
That's a perfect theme song.
I'm a
soul whose intentions are good.
I'm a soul whose intentions are good. You know, God, please don't let me be misunderstood. I do believe Candy's intentions were always good, but Candy believed she deserved more and deserved better and didn't think that her actions would hurt others around her. She thought she was above the law.
That's why I think she could be possibly childlike or like something, but you said it's popular girl syndrome.
Well, I think it is. Well, you know, under the, you know, title of popular girl syndrome, like, yeah, I think the problem is, like, yeah, she did have an immature mentality because things had always gone her way. She was stuck in that 15-year-old girl getting what she wants in high school, you know, personality. She dresses good. She gets what she wants. She looks good. She makes everybody happy. She does this. Everyone follows along. And so, like, this is the first time that she was just rudely interrupted with, like, nope, life doesn't go how you plan.
It's actually a very good analysis. Yeah.
Thank you. So his affair with Candy Montgomery was infiltrating and having a negative effect on his family life and home life. And at the first sight of his wife, Betty Gore, bringing up that something was wrong, Alan Gore was ready to end it. And Betty Gore knew something was, you know, incongruent with their marriage, and proposed going to a church-related event called Marriage Encounter. And when this was proposed to Alan, he was all for it. He was ready to end the affair with Candy and put his best foot forward with his own marriage.
Yeah, even though Betty didn't know that he was having an affair, but he was ready to recommit. Or at least Marriage Encounter made them recommit. And if Marriage Encounter sounds culty, it's because it might be. But
dun, it, dun, dun.
Yeah, it did change the trajectory, bad or good, for Alan and Betty's marriage. They went there and they really did reconnect. They wrote each other. Like, part of Marriage Encounter was, you know, like, you would have to journal each night and, like, yeah, that means, that seems silly or whatever, and, like, tell each other your true feelings. And part cold tea. The reason why this also needs to be a part two is I haven't had the chance totally to look into Marriage Encounter. I have the rest of the next episode written in terms of the trial and the outcome, but I can't talk about Marriage Encounter unless I find out if it's actually culty. Because Pat Montgomery actually says to Candy, at least in the dramatization, when she proposes it to him. So Betty and Alan go. Alan breaks off the relationship with Candy. Candy, so desperate to not be ignored, finds a reason to call him after she was like, okay, we won't talk anymore, whatever. And then picks up the phone, I don't know, days later or something. He's like, hey, I know this is inappropriate. We're not supposed to talk, but I just had a question.
About Marriage Encounter. Yeah, it was just the most obvious plea for communication.
I feel like I've done bullshit like that before. And I was felt like 16. Very like,
is this seventh grade? Like, yeah. I'm having flashbacks to a call I made to an ex that was like,
did I leave something at your
house? Oh, I feel like, yeah, I might have left something at your house. Yeah.
I told your mom that I would help her pick up. Phony baloney.
Phony baloney.
Well, guys, this, okay, if it just seems like this is just star-crossed lovers or whatever, this case goes so much deeper. I intended it to be one episode. I apologize for the people who don't like two-parters, but sometimes when you research something, you can't not go deeper. And the trial, the lawyers, the characters involved with that.
The axe murder?
That one I actually want to brush over. That's why you're doing this with me, because I have to walk out of the room when they show that. I actually retched. I got physically sick.
Pretty horrifying.
It's heartbreaking, too. Rest in peace, Betty Gore. And till next week, just, hey, feel free to watch those dramatization series, but maybe wait until we're done with this, then watch them and see how you feel. I don't know. Or just do it. Hey, do it at your leisure. See how you feel. But I bet you're going to want to watch those, because there's just so many opinions you can have about this.
They got me hooked. Mm-hmm. The Hulu one took 20 minutes, but then I was hooked.
Mm-hmm.
They set it up good. At first, I'm just going to say this, you know, shout out to Hulu. Really turning this story on its head. I hated the first 20 minutes until it happened. And then I was like, I love those 20 minutes. They took me to 1979 in Wiley, Texas. They brought me there and I was like, I got no business being here. I'm bored out of my mind. They made me understand Candy Montgomery.
What Greg's trying to say, Hulu, is please don't dismiss his resume as a director. He's a great director and producer just because he didn't like 20 minutes of the series, all right?
I just thought I could do the first 20 minutes better, but then I'll admit
all right, Candy.
I was wrong. Maybe they could have got it with just 10. 10 minutes of exposition.
I thought it was kind of cool, but yeah, it was. I could see if you didn't know. So I knew the story because I'd read the article. If you were just watching that series straight off, I'd be like, I'm with you. I'd be like, I don't. Why am I watching this?
If you didn't know why you were watching it, it's kind of like, oh, so I'm following a boring suburban housewife, soccer mom, drive from Bible school to swim practice, and okay, I'm going to change the channel.
And we're going to end this podcast right now because we are not a movie review podcast. I feel like we've really discussed a lot of that, which I'm fine with. I want to keep going, but I want you guys to... leave us 5 stars and a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And thank you guys so much for listening. It's a different format sometimes, and I hope you enjoy it. It's helpful for me to be able to talk to someone about like cases like this, because it's like constantly I'm just like, what is happening?
Until next time, don't have an affair and don't murder your neighbor with an axe.
There we go. Great advice. Love you guys. Bye.